best people that you can get to do anything and go for them. I think she was a reformer. That's not her reputation, but she was. He took the cloak of Radio 2 and he pushed it.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which we hear from those who made a difference. Leslie Douglas.
I grew up in Newcastle, obviously. Had a really, really happy childhood. Loved it. And I am the archetypical, what people say, we obviously had absolutely no money. Did not occur to me once, ever, as I was growing up. I just loved it. Two brothers who influenced my taste, because they're a lot older than me, so the Beatles and Pink Floyd and things like that my older brother would listen to meant that that had an influence on me, along with my dad, who used to listen to Sinatra and etc. So my tastes, I think, have always been slightly older. I did nothing out of the ordinary at all at school, and then what's happened is people who I was at school with or at college with, or teachers have occasionally got in touch with me to go, yeah, we always knew that you were going to do something. And I think, no, you didn't. This sounds weird, but it was quite interesting being brought up in Newcastle, in Long Benton first, and then Killingworth, the hotbed of Newcastle United fans, being a Sunderland supporter. All my life, being a Sunderland supporter. And that sounds ridiculous, but it was quite hard at times at school, because it really is the beating heart of the North East is football. And I did get into quite big rows at school about football. And it was only because my dad always took me to Roker Park, and most of my family are from Sunderland. So I've always been a Sunderland fan, and I think that kind of defined me when I was very young and at school.
Now, let me just recap for the listeners who will probably be wondering what on earth we're talking about at the moment. Somebody rang up on Monday, and we were having a general discussion about defence, really, and how we lack
in defence. The very first radio that I can remember having a massive impact on me was James Whale on Metro Radio. I've never met him. I've never worked with him. I don't love a lot of what he did. But when I was listening, and again, he was on late night and I shouldn't have been listening, so I was listening on the transistor. And he used to make me so angry because of how he cut callers off. But he did it brilliantly. And obviously, that's the reaction he was trying to get. And I couldn't switch the radio off. And I thought then, wow, you're absolutely in control. And then the other programme that I listened to a lot was Round Midnight on Radio 2. And I know that now you'd go, well, obviously. But as a teenager in Newcastle, who, you know, was into pop music, I do know why I listened to it. I thought the guests were incredible. And when you're flicking around for something good to listen to late at night then, apart from the speech stuff like James Whale, there wasn't anything.
Hello, and first of all, a very happy new year to all our listeners. I suppose a happy old new year to any Chinese listeners around who might still be enjoying the year of the snake.
Around Midnight had fantastic guests, and I didn't have a clue who Brian Matthew was, but I loved that programme.
Well, here we go, with the first of what I hope is going to turn
the breadth of the people who they had on, the cosiness of it, and obviously Brian's voice was just incredible. Then at the other side of the day, I listen to Radio 1, obviously. And for me, Noel Edmonds will always be my breakfast show presenter.
There's a new lineup on 247 Metres. Noel Edmonds here on your breakfast show for this Wednesday morning and each and every weekday morning at 9 o'clock, Tony Blackburn.
I went to a big comprehensive school. Had been a grammar school, it wasn't when I went there. And there was one teacher who was an English teacher who, when people talk about inspirational teachers, that is what he was. And he managed to inspire everybody. I always loved reading, I still love words. I love words and I love how they're put together. I love books. And I always did. And again, because my brothers were older than me, there were always books that were just that bit older than me that I would read. But this teacher put his arm around me metaphorically and gave me stuff to read that I wouldn't have already read. He engendered my love of English, and that's why I did English at university. And I went to Manchester because it seemed like a cool place to go. Because the thing that I'd never been away from home at all. So moving away from home was a big thing for me. Again, I can remember being in my room and thinking, I don't even know where I am really. And I put the radio on and it was Piccadilly Radio. And all of those things, it's always been through my whole career when people talk about that relationship, that the intimate and close relationship that radio has with people. I was there thinking, everybody here is cleverer than me, which they were. They were certainly all posher than me. Nobody spoke like me. And yet I listened to Dave Ward on Piccadilly, or you know, Sweeney was on at that time as well. And I just thought, oh no, I understand Manchester because of Piccadilly Radio.
So I'd like you to phone me on 061 228 6262 and tell MS about the chat-up lines you've used or are going to use. Or
when I finished university, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. And an English degree doesn't really set you up for anything apart from teaching, which I knew I didn't want to do. So I did a kind of personal assistant stroke business studies course at a college in York. Learned shorthand, typing. Who knew that typing would be that useful? It's the most useful thing I can do is that I can type really quickly. So I did that at York. Still didn't have a clue what I wanted to do, or what I, not what I wanted to do, but what I could do. I didn't really have things presented to me as options. And then the BBC were one of the employers that came round and talked to people. And then they asked if anybody was interested in joining the BBC. And I still now can't imagine what in my head made me think that I would ever get into the BBC. But my friend from college was moving to London, and I was desperate to go to London with her, so I wanted a job in London. So the BBC came round, interviewed me, and they gave me a job as a production secretary. And so I moved to London on £4,000 a year. First thing I did was I was put into subject specialists, which was a specialist research thing. I was literally the secretary there, and getting tea and coffee is largely what I did. The first thing I did there, which I did for a month or so, was research on Tomorrow's World. Know nothing about science, but they would give me projects. I'd go to the British Library and research them, and God, I read so many newspapers and scientific magazines and stuff. Directly after that, I was put on World at One for one day. Jim Moyer said this to me, that the great thing about being in radio is that you are so close to the sharp edge. Whatever job you do, you are there. It's the sharp end. Whereas in television, there are lots and lots and lots more people. So you can be way down the chain in terms of the creative front end. And my day, and it was literally one day, World at One, that taught me he was right. Because I walked in there, you know, it was so frenetic. I'd never heard the World at One. I'd never listened to Radio 4. I walked in and the producer said to me, well, we asked for somebody who was experienced. I don't want you. Right. I said, what can you do? I said, can you type? Yes, I can type. I can definitely type. So the correspondents would come on that day and I would type while they were speaking. But I did that bit all right, the typing. And then, and this is absolutely true, they said to me, take it into the studio. And I stood outside for so long thinking, does red mean you can go in? Does green mean they're on air? So it's green because it's going ahead. Or does it mean you can go in? Or does this? I had no idea. And so I stood for ages and then watched people going in and out and worked out when I could go in. So I gave them the thing and it worked out all right. And to be fair, at the end, the producer did come to me and say, actually, you were better than we thought you might be. But it was absolutely terrifying.
The World at One. This is Robin Day with 40 minutes of news and comment this Tuesday lunchtime.
First, and then they put me in. Initially, they said, could I cover Radio 2? So nobody said where it was. And I know I should have had enough nous to go, where is it? But I didn't, I was embarrassed. So I thought it would be in Broadcasting House. Obviously, Radio 2 wasn't in Broadcasting House. So, and this is absolutely God's truth. They said to me, it's not in Broadcasting House. I thought, oh, I just didn't know where it was. I went into Capital Radio to the receptionist and said, do you know where Radio 2 is? Because I knew where Capital was. And I knew that was a radio station. I knew I listened to it. So I went in and said, you don't know where Radio 2 is, do you? And she went, I think it's down there, which was Ariel House in Charlotte Street. So I just walked up and down Charlotte Street until I found something that had a sign that said Radio 2. But that's how pathetic I was. So I was meant to work on the Ken Bruce show, and I didn't. I think they thought I wasn't good enough, had enough experience. So they put me on to the David Jacobs show. And I just... David was just the greatest person to learn from. So he was incredible to me. And his producer, Ken Evans, the brilliant Australian producer, and they were incredible to me. And I just wanted to learn. And the music that he played was music that I loved because it was the music that my dad loved. So it was Matt Monro and it, you know, and that. And David took time, and he didn't need to do it at all. He took time and said to me, I would never put this after that song. I'd only ever put that after that, and this segue works, and, you know, this is a musical, and therefore you probably want to put something that's a bit slower tempo after. And he just taught me how he built an hour's music. And Ken did exactly the same thing. I didn't know how to time records at the time it was records. Actually, how to describe a fade and how to describe an intro and what was really important in the information. And David very famously had cards for every track that he played. And we'd update the cards and I'd do... And Ken knew everything in the world, as did David. And they spent so much time with me, just teaching me how radio worked.
Hello there, and welcome. If this is the time of day that you can take a break, our music is designed to keep you company and make your break that much happier.
I just adored David all my career. I just think David was so funny and had done everything. You know, had done Question Time, had done Jukebox Jury, and was a legend. And he was such a gentleman. And they kept me there for longer and longer and longer, and then I was put on an attachment there. And then a job came up for a production assistant in Radio 2. So I went for the job, and I didn't get it. I did an appalling interview. It was the first interview, proper interview I'd ever done. It was for a production assistant, and I went into the room, and there were five people interviewing me. So I didn't get the job, and Ken and David... And actually, Jeff Mullen, whose assistant didn't get the job either, they all went mad about it. So from there, they tried to find me some job for me to do. And they put me into promotions, on-air trails. Again, I didn't even know what they were. Ian Purden was head of presentation, who was incredibly supportive. I have been so lucky in the people who I've worked for. I was working to the brilliant, the person who started just after I started, but he came in as producer, was Dirk Maggs. And so I worked for him, and that was a massive learning curve because he wanted rights to things, he was doing pastiches of things, he was absolutely brilliant, and he taught me that the atmosphere in the office really matters. And then he left. I went for the job as promotions producer. Didn't get that either. I was incredibly successful, as you can, didn't get that. They gave the job to Alex Lester. And as he would say, wasn't really a hand-in-glove fit. Because Alex is an on-air turn. That's what he is. And he did it to get into Radio 2. To be fair, it worked. Absolutely worked. But he didn't do a lot, I would say. He largely sat with his feet up on the... He would say this. Sat with his feet up on the desk reading the paper. Tossed off some scripts for trails. Brilliant. when he tried, but he just wanted to be, at the time, a newsreader and then get to do Knight Ride at the time, I guess. So I didn't get the production assistant's job, but then an attachment came up as a producer. So I did a year of doing things like Gloria Hunniford. I did Round Midnight, which I just loved doing that. Everybody had said to me, Brian's quite difficult to work with, because obviously he knew what he wanted to do. He knew everybody. He'd interviewed everybody. So you had to keep up with him. And I've always thought that. When they're in front of the microphone, nobody who's listening thinks there's somebody messing it up who's a producer or an assistant producer. Everything is on the presenter. But from day one, I got on with him. I really, really loved him.
That was music by Fauré, the Allegro Vivo from his violin.
We had a great time, and anybody who ever worked on it would tell you, you know, you always took him to dinner, so you'd go to the same Italian, you'd have dinner with him, then you'd go in and do the show. And then actually, when I was on Round Midnight, I got him to play Bruce Springsteen. Obviously, Bruce Springsteen is my hero, and nobody on Radio 2 would play Bruce Springsteen. But I played One Step Forward, Two Steps Back, I'll always remember. And Brian said to me, if you think it's right for Radio 2, I'll play it. And he played it. So proud. And I loved doing that programme.
Woke up this morning, the house was cold. Checked the furnace, she wasn't burning.
So there was kind of a mix of attachments, doing producer attachments, and at some point in all of that as well, I did the producer's training course, which you did after you'd been a producer, really. So I spent a month just... Bizarre course that was. I did not know what a controller was. And when I was on the producer training course, they said, well, we're very lucky because we've got the controller of Radio 4 coming to talk. And I thought, well, I don't even know what a controller is. I've never listened to Radio 4. And it was Michael Green. And he gave a talk about Radio 4 and about radio. And I just thought, yeah, whatever you do, I want a bit of that. Wasn't even because it was just about radio and about audio and what grabs people and what the opportunities were. But he got us all to sit in a circle. And he sat in the middle and he said, everybody tell me one word that you associate with Radio 4. And everybody were Radio 4 listeners. So everybody was saying, you know, intelligent, warm. And he got to me and I just went, don't listen. And because he was who he was, that was what he was interested in. You know, why don't you listen? And I said, why would I? I haven't known. And he said, so what's the word that comes into your mind when you think you're not going to listen? And I said, patronising, I suppose. But it's unfair because I never listened to it. But it's certainly not for me. And afterwards, he took me to one side and had a big conversation about why I didn't listen. And he was... A brilliant man. And then from there, I became editor of presentation and planning, so I was doing the schedules with Ian. And then Ian left, and he said to Francis Lyne that they should let me run it, which was ludicrous, really.
We're with you night and day, across the UK, it's Radio 2.
I think what Radio 2 was then, what it had been previously and what it is now, is the same thing, which is it was a family. It still is a family. It was an incredibly warm place to work because people who work there really care about the output and really care about the audience, and they really do. And that shone through for me through the whole thing. Francis did amazing things at Radio 2, changing it, you know, changing the nature of continuity, losing, and probably some people disagree, but losing the orchestral stuff in the middle of the day. She changed the schedule massively and so started that regeneration of Radio 2. And then, of course, Terry came back to do Breakfast.
You may be aware of certain gaps in the free flow of the badinage, and that is because my hands are not doing what my brain tells them to. And my brain isn't in any great state either.
At that time, it felt like it wasn't connected to anything else. It felt like it was its own little world. And I think that possibly is the biggest difference from now to what it was then. But then there was no connection with the music industry. There was no connection to other parts of the media or even radio stations. And there wasn't even a great competition in terms of Radio 1 and Radio 2, or Radio 2 and commercial radio. It just felt very different, partially because when I was first there, it was in Charlotte Street. So it literally wasn't connected to anything. At the time, the BBC, and Francis was part of that, it was very much, there's a controller in an office and they run it. And if you go in there, it's terrifying. And it was. And her link to the world was David Virko. The controller then was more distant from the on-air talent. And as I say, David sat between Francis and the people who made it work. So Francis was quite a distant but very in control figure. But I have to say, when I then had to move into her orbit as I started doing more things, really clever about radio, really understood Radio 2, whatever anybody says, she really understood Radio 2, and was, again, incredibly supportive of me personally. And I think she was a reformer. That's not her reputation, but she was a reformer. And she really cared, and she was a laugh. Once she got beyond the door of her office, which was just terrifying, the people that I worked with in that job were the announcers and the newsreaders, Charles Nove, Steve Madden, Patrick, James Alexander Gordon, who really did have the greatest stories ever. They were the people that I mostly worked with.
Aston Villa 1, Coventry City 0. Everton 1.
I started to get pulled into things that were outside of Radio 2. I was put on a group that was looking at daytime television because it was deemed that we would understand the daytime audience. So I did stuff like that. I did some audience stuff. So I started to get pulled out into other things. And another person who was amazing in my career, and I've never worked for them, is Tim Blackmore. There was a commissioning seminar. I think it was probably the first commissioning seminar that Radio 2 had done when Francis was there. And at the end, Tim came up to me, who I'd met a couple of times, but I didn't. He came up to me and he said, and I talked to you about some of what's been said. And I went, yeah, why would you ask me? And he said, because I assume you know. And he then suggested that I get involved in the Radio Academy and the Radio Festival. And he was saying to me, you need to see more of the industry than just sat in Radio 2. And so he pulled me out into that. And so I worked on the Radio Festival very, very early on in my career. And that was him just putting me on, getting somebody to put me on the committee. And he then always was my mentor. Tim Blackmore is an astounding man in the industry, I think. Never owed me anything, but he just always helped me. So I started to do that, get pulled into other things. And then Francis left and Jim arrived. That was quite a culture change. Jim had run entertainment in the BBC and comedy, and so was instrumental in things like French and Saunders, One Foot in the Grave, had worked with legends like Mike Yarwood, The Generation Game was Jim, Wogan's television show he commissioned. So he genuinely is a legend in television, BBC television. He was Deputy Director of Corporate Affairs before he came to Radio 2. Because the other thing about Jim is the greatest raconteur you will ever find. Amazing with talent and spotting talent, but also incredibly corporate and quite military, as he would say. He used military terms all the time. So he was a mix of all of those things. So corporate affairs suited him because he could deal with the politics, but was also a human being. And his humour got him through a lot of things. And he was royal liaison as well at a very, very difficult point. So he landed in from nowhere. Nobody had expected Jim. But I'm told, I'm sure this is true, that he got the job because Francis Lyne had said to Liz, you should think about Jim. And then he arrived as a television entertainment person in the middle of Radio 2. And Jim arrived, and I thought, I started to look at other jobs. And I wanted to go and work in Birmingham. Surely I can get a job in Birmingham working for Radio 2. Because I thought, it's just a new turn of the wheel and other people are coming in and Jim will have a different... And then I met Jim and thought, oh, wow. And then Liz Forgan was director of radio, came to my tiny little office in this corner of the ground floor of Weston House. And she sat down and she said, please will you stay for 6 months? It's just too much change if you go now. Don't apply for other jobs. See how it goes with Jim, because I think it'll work. He came in, he looked at how things were done. The thing that Jim brought immediately was ambition. There's not a bone in Jim's body that will ever go, well, it's good, isn't it, because we're second in the market there. So he came in and he said, cast up. And I've always used that phrase all my career since, cast up. Never assume people will say no, always assume they will say yes. So look for the best people that you can get to do anything and go for them. We had so many strategy days, threw around so many names, and I can remember him, and he talks about this. We had an away day for kind of the management team of Radio 2, and he'd said to me, come up with a 5-year plan for Radio 2 that we knew we were going to have to save money, so that saves money, but is a schedule that you think would be right for that, just a structure of a schedule. And I could still put up these things on the wall. And went, so this would be the first year, second year. I put up the fifth year. And he went, right, we're stopping now. And he took me outside. And we walked around the garden. He went, don't ever do that again. What? And he went, that's frightening. So we threw all of that away. And then we sat down again and talked about how you could, you know, because it did need to be kickstarted. Terry coming back had kickstarted it. But you needed something to kickstart it again beyond Terry having come back. And that was when Jim said, we need to bring somebody in. We need to do something. And Paul Robinson, who was doing strategy for radio then, had said, you should do that on Saturday mornings. And that was when Jim went, I want Steve Wright. And I said, why do you want Steve Wright? Because there's loads of people. Why are you just going Steve Wright? And he just literally went, I want Steve Wright.
We're taking a short radio break, so a few thank yous. Firstly, to you for listening. Thank you very much. I can't even begin to tell you how much we love you and how much I appreciate it. In BBC Radio, thanks to Stuart Grundy, Doreen Davis, Dave Tate, Trevor Dan, Ron Belchier,
internally,
Dave Price, Ted Best, and
Jim carried everybody Jonathan with Ruffle, him. So everybody was up for it, internally, I would say. Externally, it went down like a lead balloon when he first started. Obviously, you go from perfectly good Saturday morning, and then you land Steve in, and you go, oh, that's different. But the other thing is, Steve is really clever. He just knows. You can't be at the top for as long as he has and just do it as well as he does. And he played it really cleverly. And what Steve did was connected to the rest of the output. He didn't come in and go, well, I'm different. He came in and talked up everything. He talked up the bits of the schedule that had been there for a long time. He talked up the things that people associated with Radio 2. He took the cloak of Radio 2 and he pushed it. It's respect to him, because it was a big decision for him to come at that point. But that was the start of everything changing. Yeah. Never doubted that Steve would work, ever. And actually, I never doubted that Radio 2 kind of becoming more contemporary would work. Because the other big thing that Jim did, which was about it being isolated, we sat down and were saying, we didn't get serviced a lot of music. We certainly never got any breadth of artists on there. There were certain things that we absolutely cornered the market in, but there were loads of people who wouldn't stand a canal's chance of getting. So Jim said, right, let's go to the industry. So we went to the music industry one by one by one by one and said, why do you ignore us? And then did the same with the artists as well. That he just brought scale and ambition. And it was really infectious, really infectious. Jim would never say this is a bad idea. He'd always try and make it into a really good idea. He loved it. He loved taking something and trying to make it better. And that can be really irritating if you're a producer, because you think, oh, that's going to get bought, isn't it? And then it isn't bought, because it's been a process to see, could it get to the point where it could be bought? Culturally, he totally changed it. And in terms of profile, the rest of the BBC was then going, oh, that's Jim Moyer. So Jim could pick up the phone to anybody and was working with the DG, it was John Burt at the time, and he was working with him all the time as royal liaison, incredibly well connected as well. So he had talent connections, he had BBC corporate connections, everybody revered him in terms of what he had achieved. So all of a sudden, there was an attention on Radio 2 that there hadn't been before. It was just an incremental, and I know at the time, dear God, did we talk about it all the time? Is it incremental? Is it revolution? It wasn't revolution, it was incremental. We brought in a different kind of person to do specialist music as well. It was bringing in people like Marc Lamar to do rock and roll, which at the time felt very different than wasn't bringing people in like Stuart McConey into the fold of Radio 2. We thought very carefully about people who really did love and know about music, because that has to be at the heart of Radio 2. One of the first signings that Jim did actually to promote further on Radio 2 was Paul Gambaccini. That kind of got written out of, you know, the story of Radio 2. And then, of course, you go, oh, well, the weekends are great, aren't they? And everything, you know, oh, God, I'm going to have to look at date. Oh, God, do we have to? And at the time, Colin Martin was head of music as well and was brilliant as well. But with someone like Colin Martin sitting across things and Jeff Mullen before that, you knew that the music was going to be the right music for Radio 2. But then we started to look at daytime. Steve moved from Saturdays into weekday afternoons.
Hello. This is Steve here on Radio 2. Doing there, all right. So nice to be back with you. I just can't tell you.
And then Johnny and Drive Time. It was evolution, whatever anybody says, it was evolution. You know, and Parkinson on Sunday mornings. There were some great programmes. I think some of the documentaries that we did were sublime, but it was incremental, it was thought through. And there were things that we never compromised on, like Pause for Thought. You know, there was, and Jim, of course, was very keen on covering religious affairs quite extensively in the station, and we did a lot of that, and we did comedy specials, and his Saturday hour of comedy was really big.
You probably realise by now, like, the aim of local radio is to fill in time between the news, right?
Jim made me head of programmes. Well, I was his number two, and that was a massive leap of faith for him. It was never my ambition to be a controller. And head of programmes is the greatest job in the world, because you get to do everything, but you're not the controller. So, awful lot of power with no responsibility. But it then became, as Jim started to chart when he would want to leave, and Jenny was director, and Jenny talked to me about it, and then Greg, who appointed me. But various people started to talk to me about being controller, and it kind of just happened. I think once Jim decided to go, that was a big decision for me, because either you go for controller or you leave. So I stayed to be controller, although I never thought I'd get it. I genuinely didn't think I'd get it. It was a long, long process and a lot of interviews. My dad was still alive when I was working with Jim, and we all went out to lunch, and Jim made me probably go and pay, which is what Jim usually did. And when I came back, we walked back over to Western House, and my dad said to me, he's just told me you're going to be controller of Radio 2. And that was when I was very first working with Jim. So anyway, yeah. In some ways, it was business's usual, because Jim was incredibly generous, I mean, incredibly generous to me, and included me in every, I mean, there wasn't anything that I wasn't included in with him. Obviously, I knew all of the presenters. I knew all of their agents, all of the contractual side. I was across the business side of it. I was across. All of that was straightforward, really, in lots of ways. And there were brilliant people around me, you know, like Lewis, who obviously is running it now, and, you know, Phil Hughes, who was largely running the productions, was brilliant. And Hester, who was our head of press, was amazing and just one of my best friends. The bit that you have to then go, oh God, is when you have a profile. And I never wanted a profile. It was never what I sought. But when you're controller of a radio, I think more than a television channel, you are kind of the embodiment of what the station is. Not the embodiment, but the personification of it. So people, the press, want to talk to you about it. And they want to know who you are, and so do the audience. And I can remember, this is slightly different, I was at South by Southwest. We did quite a lot from South by Southwest, and it was when the Kaiser Chiefs were first launching. They were really hot, and everybody wanted to see the Kaiser Chiefs. They were doing a gig for Radio 1, and I got in to see them, and then went back to the hotel. And I saw this guy came over, well, two guys came over and sat down, and I thought, I recognise you. And it was Ricky and Simon from the Kaiser Chiefs. And they went, we're told you're now running Radio 2. Yes. And they said, if you drop Popmaster, we will never do anything for your station. Why? They said, whenever we're going up and down the country, we do Popmaster. You cannot drop Popmaster. It's Ricky Wilson saying that to you. You go, this is ludicrous. And of course, what happened during this time was that Six Music was launched, and Jenny, Six Music was nothing to do with Radio 2 initially, or the management, and then Jenny asked me to look at it, and then obviously me and Jim launched it. And at that point, we were bringing in presenters in any case, and Mark and Lard were on radio. And I was in quite an awe of meeting them, and we took them out to dinner, and Radio 1 didn't know. That was very naughty. And I will tell this story. Jim got them confused because they both called Mark. So he got very confused about which one was Mark Radcliffe and which one was Mark Riley. And they both really wanted to move to Radio 2 and Six Music. So I was the person who said, well, let's do Mark Radcliffe here and Mark Riley there.
Well, we're at the Cambridge Folk Festival, and seeing as you're in a sports jacket and emerald green shirt, I mean, in tight-fitting jeans, if you go and buy one of those straw hats, your urban cowboy look will be complete.
I like to think I'm carrying on the tradition that Grandpa
really cared, and I really wanted to be close to them because that's what the station is. The people who produce it and the people who are on air are what the station is. So Terry was the perfect example of where you think, I think I've got a good relationship with Terry. And then I'd hear on air him saying something like, I assume management are on holiday. Must have been on holiday for a long time because I haven't seen them for a long time. And I think, I should have to go in the studio now. So I'd go in the studio. He would say things on air that would go, oh, I need to pull my socks up there, don't I? And when I got the job, he took me out for breakfast and just told me how to be a controller. And he's an amazing man. I know everybody has said that quite rightly, but he really was. Everything that anybody says he was. Hilarious, wrong, brilliant. And there was no difference between Terry on air and off air.
Bill Withers. It's the chill weather.
The thing that's really hard is when you are close to people, and I think I did have some close relationships with some, and when you have to then make hard decisions, that's the bit of the job that I hated most. Sometimes it isn't that anybody isn't doing a great job in the show that they're doing, it's just there's so many different things that are brought to bear, and sometimes you have to make decisions that you don't want to with people that you really respect and really like. And I think I genuinely can't think of a presenter that I didn't like. And certainly I don't think there were any that I didn't respect for what they did. They were, why would you have them on Radio 2 if they weren't that? You know, how lucky to have worked with people like Alan Freeman. And people forget, he did an opera show on Radio 2. It was a brilliant show. Absolutely brilliant, because you think of Pick of the Pops. He did the most brilliant opera series.
And thanks again for your company this evening as we lift the lid on another collection of classical cuts with their greatest bits.
And I worked with Alan Freeman. I mean, that's not odd, is it? It's really, and Sheila Tracy. You know, you had absolute legends of people that you were. I can remember when I was, Sheila was coming off Big Band Special, and I took her out to tell her, and we sat down and I took her to a hotel and said, what would you like to drink? And she said, the only time management ever offer you a drink is when they're firing you. And I said, would you like a gin and tonic? And she just burst out laughing. And she was, because she, I mean, you don't get to be Sheila Tracy, you know, in that world at that time, in the big band world, and being a woman, and she was strong, but she was amazing. And she just said, well, at some point it's going to happen, so thank you for buying me a gin and tonic at least.
Good evening, and welcome to the 500th Big Band Special, coming to you from the Hippodrome Golders Green, where our audience includes fans, musicians,
I hope,
singers...
And there will obviously be loads of presenters who say they never saw me and had no relationship with me, I would imagine. But I always tried to feel and be close to the on-air talent. I loved it.
Christopher Evans on your radio. You can be sure it ain't no country show.
There are some decisions that aren't really decisions. So Michael Foster rung me up and said, would you meet with Chris Evans? Now, I had never met Chris. I'd seen Chris around a bit. I'd never met him. I used to listen to him on GLR and thought he was incredible. I thought he was brilliant on Radio 1. Some of the stuff that he did on Breakfast on Virgin, I just thought was some of the funniest stuff I've ever heard. For me, Chris spans the generation that I knew what media was. Obviously, I was going to say yes, I'd meet him. Why would you not? How could you not? Just out of respect. And he had done, and, you know, commercial radio doesn't get enough acknowledgement for this. They had done that day of that charity day, which Chris had done. But they had got in there first with him. I walked in and I was absolutely so nervous, thinking, oh, my God, it's Chris Evans. And, you know, and what an incredible human being. And you think everything he'd gone through, and obviously I knew what had happened at Radio 1 from what Matthew had said. And obviously, I read all the papers, in any case. Not that you could believe what you read in the papers. And I walked in and I just met this man who had such self-awareness. It was untrue and so generous and just wanted to put his toe back into radio more regularly. Would I ever think of him on Radio 2? And at the time, we obviously, BBC loves a bit of research. And what I didn't really pay that much attention to the research, to be honest. But one thing I did always think was that our audience were really nice and liked people who had been through stuff. And so, you know, when all the stuff, and I don't even bring it up again, but all the stuff that happened with someone like Johnny, they loved him more for being human and dealing with everything and then dealing with his cancer. And, you know, the audience love Johnny because he's a proper person. He has had a proper life and is still brilliant. And I saw in Chris somebody who had been through a lot and knew who he was now and knew what he wanted to be and was grown up. So he did bank holiday specials, that's what he did initially. And then it was incremental, because that's what we thought, just get him in, see what people think. And on his first Saturday show, I was driving over the Pennines, and I had the radio on, and he opened the fader, and I just turned to the person I was with and said, that's going to work. It's going to work. He did the Saturday show, and then he was going, I want to do more. So then he did Drive Time, and then, you know, he was obviously the person who should take over when Terry decided to go. He just obviously was the person. Chris was colossal. I mean, he defined a decade. And then to come back and define a different decade in a different demographic, you're a special person to do that.
Good afternoon, friends, and thanks for tuning in. We are all for one and one for all here on this Wednesday tea time. Hope you well. Now, chucks away.
Whatever anybody thinks of talent who are as big as Chris, I've encountered very few people who are as open to other ideas or opinions as Chris. So if I ever said, I don't think that will work, he didn't do it. Or we'd discuss it and I go, oh, actually it might. So everything was a discussion with Chris. And I found him incredibly easy to manage. And I did have an ongoing discussion and relationship with him. And I think the only way to, and it's a ridiculous word, manage talent, you can't, but the only way to get the best out of on-air talent, I think, is to have an ongoing relationship, a consistent relationship, because otherwise all you're ever doing is going, that was brilliant, that was rubbish. The important thing is that you can talk about things so that they don't become big issues. I think I had that with Chris.
Hello, Chris. I've now listened to almost your entire show, but I've only travelled 9 miles along the South Circular in that time.
The BBC were incredibly good to me. They taught me everything. Gave me experience at BBC Worldwide because I wanted to know more about the commercial world. They were brilliant. They gave me Six Music to, and on an ongoing basis, the people above you are always close. I mean, you know, so Jenny Abramsky was my director. I mean, should have been director general of the BBC. I think she's a brilliant woman. Absolutely terrifying and so supportive. That's what you get in the BBC, or I had when I was there. Mark Thompson as DG, who I know, you know, people can say, he's a bit stiff and a big sort of set piece, isn't he? When you're sat with him, he's brilliant. Where it gets tense is when it comes under scrutiny. And when it's like that, then it becomes a very big corporation and a very big beast. If you don't work there, what you don't realise is quite the scrutiny that the BBC does come under. Obviously, it comes under scrutiny in the press and by the audiences, but it comes under a lot of political scrutiny as well. And that's really hard. And that could be really, really hard. I would say, through everything that I went through at the BBC, I never felt, and I genuinely mean this, I never felt like any part of the BBC was anything other than supportive. Always incredibly supportive. They could be portrayed as a particular thing, and they're not. They really care about the services and the audiences. But you end up having to have conversations about things that aren't that. And so you look like an apparatchik. You look like you're just a corporate person, and they're not. So I always felt really supported. Frances was a strong woman. Jenny was a very strong woman and very supportive of women. You know, Helen Bowden was controller of Radio 4 before she went to news. You know, this BBC's had very strong women in it. I never, ever felt anything other than people were supporting me because they wanted to help me. So I went on maternity leave twice at quite crucial moments of when, and they worked around me going on maternity leave. Jim worked around me going on maternity leave. So they were incredibly flexible, but they did things like kept me involved. And I never, ever felt that being a woman was in any way prejudicial to what I did or affected what I did or who I was at all. And I genuinely mean that. At no point.
BBC News at 6 o'clock. Good evening, this is Fran Godfrey. The controller of Radio 2, Leslie Douglas, has resigned. She announced a few minutes ago that it was her decision in response to...
I find it really difficult to look back, because it was 10 years ago, and such a lot has happened around the place that I look back and I can't now really believe it happened. I can't believe it happened. I will never talk about it in detail because it affects, still affects some people who were involved in it. Is what was in the press correct? No. Surprise, surprise. Should it have happened? No, of course it shouldn't have. Whatever happened on the show, it was Radio 2 that put it out. We put it out. And that's why I resigned. Purely that. When you have a Prime Minister making a comment on a late-night radio show, the world felt crazy. And however crazy the world got, and it got really crazy, and I had to move out of my house, and it was mad, and my kids were getting photographed, and it was awful. It was awful. I have to put that to one side and go, should it have happened? Should we have put it out? No. No. So the maelstrom that happened, that I think there was a confluence of the BBC was in a very particular place where people were looking. I think there were very big personalities involved. And also, from where I was sat, it was the first time, I think, that digital allowed such an influx of complaints very quickly from people who hadn't heard it, from people. But should it have happened? No. And that's why I resigned. But it doesn't stop me thinking, wow, that stuff that happened around it was, you know, to have your face on the 10 o'clock news is a very strange experience, like an out-of-body experience. It felt like I'd died and I was reading my own obits. I did have to move out of my house, and I went and stayed with a friend. Sat in his garden, drinking quite a lot of wine, thinking, oh my God, what is happening? And Chris rung me up and said, I want to see you. I said, I'm not going. And he said, no, you're going to see me. So I did. And he just gave me a talking to about don't disappear, and you put your best foot forward and you carry on. And I will never forget that he did that, ever. It was a very, 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 very strange time. And I never sought press, ever. It wasn't ever what I wanted to do. So going through that was bizarre and horrible. But before anybody knew what I was doing, they didn't need to stay in touch with me. They didn't. I had no power at all. And they stayed in touch, and they were brilliant. And, you know, people often say lazily in the business, well, when you're not of any use, you know, sort of presenters, why would they, or staff, or why would... Absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. The most amazing people stayed in touch. Commercial radio were lovely to me. And I know they spent 10 years hammering me, but at that point, they were absolutely... The industry was so supportive, and Radio 2. And Radio 2 needed a lot of support then. And I think Bob, him going into Radio 2 and stabilising it, and, you know, again, people forget that, what a colossal job that was to calm people down at that point and to make sure that Radio 2 continued to do what Radio 2 should be doing. The BBC owes a gratitude to Bob for doing that. And Lewis, who sat there holding the whole thing together with me going, I don't know what I'm doing, and Lewis keeping everything going. Because although it was horrible for me, it wasn't great for them or anybody in Radio 2. And the whole network became tarnished by stuff that they should never have been tarnished by, ever.
The BBC's Director General Mark Thompson is to meet the body that represents licence fee payers to discuss what action he'll take about the obscene phone calls made by Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross on
Lucien
Radio
Grange
2.
Called Russell me Brand has... the minute he heard I'd resigned. And he was getting on a plane to come back to the UK, and he called me and said, I've wanted you to come here forever, come to Universal. And him and then David Joseph, who took it, they were amazing. I've been so lucky that wherever I've gone, there have been these incredible people. I mean, Lucien is I mean, he really is terrifying, but I think he is a genius. I think Lucien Grange is a genius and funny and brilliant. But I also, you know, David running the UK label in the way was so supportive of me. What was good was going from a massive organisation into another massive organisation, because they understood that. The bit that was difficult was actually what my job was. That was more difficult. I started working with a producer and an independent, so we were looking at doing co-productions together between Universal and him, who was Tony Wood, who actually was one of the people who devised TOWIE. Brilliant, brilliant producer. I was then headhunted to go and work with him at Lime, and it was in Liverpool. I've been really lucky in that I've been able to incrementally kind of move forward. And now, you know, I still work with the BBC and Channel 4, etc. What I really love is that there isn't a massive infrastructure. The person, and John Myers said this to me, everybody said this to me, Clive Fisher said this to me, all you need to know is cash flow. It's not about profitability, it's about cash flow. It's a lesson I've had to learn, but I now understand. But I miss the family and the ability to do things quickly. And I have to say, I text Chris this every single week. Chris's Friday morning show. God, I wish I was there. I just love that Friday show. That Friday breakfast show, for me, is exactly what radio can do like nothing else. Because I love what you can get from radio. I love it. It was just magic last night on my way home. You know, I miss the intimacy of it. I miss the immediacy of it. I miss the people. I think it was a beautiful time to have done what I did. When you've got people like John Myers as your competition in commercial radio, it's not bad. And I can remember I was at breakfast with John, and he said to me, "You look a bit worried." And I said, "I am, but I can't tell you why." And he said, "Yes, and yes." And he said, "Well, just tell me. You can tell me. I'm not going to tell anyone." I said, "I can't. You're the competition." He said, "Oh, just tell me." I said, "I'm really worried because I'm about to announce. Oh, God, I'm about to announce I've signed Chris Evans." And I met him and he went, "Well, that's your issue for today." But, "Well, yes, because, you know, the press will be..." He went, "That's your issue for today." Said, "Do you know what I would give to have that issue today?" "Yeah, okay." But you can't, you know, it was friendly but serious competition. You know, and with people like Paul Brown, you know, it's just great, great people. How lucky to have been in the industry at a point when those people were the people that I could look up to, because I was promoted very quickly. And so you get further away from doing stuff and being in the... Or when you are in the middle of it, you think, nobody really wants me here. I used to do that all the time when I went to OBs. I could never get it right, and I know I never got it right, as to how much I should be there and how much people are thinking, "Why are you here?" And then if I didn't go, they'd go, "Oh, you didn't come into the truck." And I go, "Because if I go in, you tell me I'm getting in. Can I buy you a drink?" That's all I ever used to do. "Can I buy you a drink?" So I've never got that right, ever. What I would have wanted to be is, and I know I've failed in this, but what I would have wanted to be is somebody who allowed and protected people to do their best work. Whatever that, you know, whether it's Jeremy Vine doing news and current affairs in the middle of the Radio 2 schedule, or whether it's Terry doing Janet and John. Because I'm not a creative hub of things, but I love people who are, whether it's producers, production assistants, talent on screen, on air. So I'd hope that I've tried to give them the oxygen to do what they can do best, because I find that really exciting. I find it really exciting. And I hope that I've done a little bit of that. As I say, I've obviously failed at times, but yeah, that's... Because I've never really done anything myself, really. I've been connected to incredible people. I've been so lucky. And I hope that what I've tried to give back is to allow people to do what they should be doing.
Thank you.